Nice. Nice. Hollow point as well, hollow point bullets.
How can you tell?
I can see there, though.
Just from looking, oh yeah, well, the bullet has a hole in it.
Yeah.
What does that mean if it's a hollow point bullet?
I think
what
it means it causes more damage, I think.
Oh. So it's, I take it you're not a pacifist necessarily.
No, I don't, but I'm mad keen on war. I just like the technology. I just like guns. Doesn't mean you want to shoot anybody, really.
Of course.
I just, but I wouldn't call myself a pacifist, no. But on the other hand, I wouldn't. Well, in fact, but I'm just fascinated by the I don't know what it is, the weaponry. I just love knowing. I mean, I haven't shot pistol for a long, long time, but I love the experience when I did.
I'm fascinated, and I do find it really interesting and fun. And obviously, I love action films and stuff like that. But then, as soon as I think about, like, when you describe, like, I've heard of hollow points before, and then as soon as you start thinking about actually the damage it does to a human body, then I just start realizing what I'm. It's like snuff films or something. It's like I'm watching a snuff film.
Yeah.
Do you get equally horny about, like, when a new syringe is invented or a new type of surgery or something that's life-saving, a new pill?
No. No, I wouldn't call any of this horny either. That implies a sexual dimension, which I refute utterly.
Of course. Of course.
There's nothing sexual about my love of these long phallic objects that shoot things out their end.
Of course not, Alexei. Yeah.
No. You're recording this.
Yeah.
It would make it. Yeah. Well, we could. Welcome to podcast number 13 of the Alexei Sell podcast. And Talal has just informed me that a listener in Arizona has offered to send me his Glock. He sent me a photograph. I think it's a 17. And it's, I was looking at it's in two pieces. There's the pistol itself and the magazine and the shells, and they look like hollow points. And so we were talking about hollow points, and Talal implied that there was something sexual in my love of firearms, which I refute utterly. It's Freudian claptrap. I just love these phallic objects that shoot things out their ends for themselves. But seeing as this is a...
We're not condoning, you're not shipping a Glock internationally to Alexei, nor domestically. Don't send Alexei guns, please. We're not condoning that on the podcast.
No,
but that's from Jonathan in Arizona.
That would be awful.
Thank you for your email. And he said, can I ask Alexei for his position on the 9mm versus 40 caliber debate?
Obviously, I remember when I did used to shoot, that the guy that I used to shoot with was a big fan of 9mm, and he remember him saying he thought there was something delightfully European about 9mm. There was something sophisticated. The thing about 9mm is that it's got less stopping power than 40 cal. You know, by stopping power you mean kind of blowing up human flesh power, but you can get more. It is the kind of standard round now for all submachine guns, which are less popular than they used to be. We see like the Heckler & Koch MP35 is the obvious example, but all
obviously
Law and Order sidearms by and large, I think, load 9mm. So it means you get, because they're slightly smaller, you get more rounds in a magazine. 40 caliber. Obviously, it has more punch, but you can get less rounds in the magazine, and also because there is more recoil. So I think in the end, this is all theoretical because I live in Britain where none of this is allowed, But I think I would probably come down on the side of 9 mil rather than 40 cal. Really, I've fired 38 special. I've fired 45. But I think I'll probably come down on the.
What about a 69? Sorry, but the 9mm is that, I guess if you're in like Law and Order or a spy or something, you need more precision or necessarily don't want to kill the person. You just want to take their legs out or something.
It'll kill you. No, 9mm. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to horrify my audience too much with getting in, you know, too too much into this, really. But no, 9mm will do a lot of damage, really.
And so Jonathan ended the email by saying, my Glock 22 40 caliber has a greater
40 cal, is it? All right, okay.
Has a greater stopping power than a G17. Is that is that a plane?
No, G17 is a Glock. They're all Glocks.
Oh, or at least that's what the white supremacist who sold it to me said.
Well, he's probably right. It does have more, you know, it swings and roundabouts, isn't it, really? As with everything, you know, that 9mm has its advantages. Mm. 40 cal also has its advantages. I'll probably come down on 9mm, but, you know.
It's more elegant.
This will shed listeners like nobody's business, this discussion, really. So, horrified. But... let us continue with matters of warfare and matters of defense, because I thought I would start this podcast with looking at events in the news from last week. And one of the things that happened last week was that the British government sent a destroyer, HMS Defender, sailed provocatively close to the coast, the contested waters around the Crimea. Now, given my obsession with all things defense and military, one of the things that will have to happen before they sent HMS Defender close to Crimea was they would have had to make sure that it was raining, because HMS Defender is a Type 45 destroyer, and the Type 45 destroyer has a catastrophic problem in that when it gets warm, the engines stop working. And because the engines power all the weapon systems, all the Type 45 destroyers have suffered problems where they've had complete loss of power. So this is a kind of example of the kind of garbage that the British government wastes its money on, basically gives directly to British aerospace. Also, if we are re-engaging in the Crimea, we will be sending the Light Brigade off to fight in the Crimea, as we did in the 19th century. The Light Brigade being a cavalry regiment, they will be equipped with the new General Dynamics Ajax, which the papers have wrongly called a tank. I think it's an AFV, it's an armored fighting vehicle, and a parliamentary. None of this is written down. I'm doing this all from memory, which is tragic. But the Ajax, a parliamentary committee just reported, is only capable of traveling at half the recommended speed, so it can only do 20 miles an hour, and troops can only be in it for half an hour before they suffer tinnitus and vomiting. So again, this is another piece of junk which has cost billions and billions of pounds and is completely useless and may never enter service. And there's a phrase that's often used, I've heard used in engineering circles, which is, if it looks right, it is right. And if you look at a photo of the Ajax armored fighting vehicle, it looks completely fucking wrong. I've never seen an uglier looking thing in my life. Now, also, of course, are the British aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, is sailing, I think, around the South China Sea, is trying to annoy the Chinese. The Queen Elizabeth is also a piece of junk, and it's also equipped with the F-35 Lightning, the F-35B Lightning II, a plane which is, as I've talked about before, it's called the plane that broke the Pentagon. It's an extraordinary shitty piece of equipment which has great difficulty as an aircraft in taking off, flying anywhere or landing, which is kind of the point for an aircraft. And any job that the F-35B can do could also be done by a a drone that you could buy from a shop or online for 30 quid. This is, and it, although I love military equipment, it makes me crazy. I just think about all the billions and billions of pounds that have been wasted on all this junk. And you think how beautiful our cities could be if we just reapplied the money, for example, to urban development. You know, the centre of Reading could be rebuilt as ancient Athens, and we could have the Hanging Gardens of Barnsley rather than just some pieces of shitty, delusional, post-imperial garbage that float around the world, breaking down. And also the planes that are actually on the Queen Elizabeth, the majority of them are not actually Fleet Air Arm. They're actually operated by the US Marine Corps. So they're not even British. So it's a complete waste of time, all things considered. So that is...
I take it that's not the first time you've ever said the Queen Elizabeth is an awful piece of junk.
No, I do. I did. I think it was in. I think I did that. I did a bit of, which is one of the reasons, one of the things that makes me a unique stand-up comedian. That I used to do a long bit of stand-up about the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and its sister ship, the or brother, whatever some ship, the other ship, the Prince of Wales. I think that bit is actually in the last series of. Actually sells imaginary sandwich bar. If it's not, it'll be in the next suit. My you know, you won't get many comedians doing stuff about aircraft carriers, will you?
No, and I just like picturing that you're actually talking about the Queen herself as well.
Hello, Wilf. Yes, well, that was also, it was, you know, because, you know, I think that's another tip for young comedians. You know, when you do something, it should never just be about one thing. So the bit about the Queen Elizabeth was partly about, you know, it was part about class, about how everything in Britain is named after Queen Elizabeth, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's also about the utter shittiness of our arms procurement, you know. Yeah. And it's a kind of commentary on Britain as it is now that, you know, the adulation of the royal family. I noticed the headline, because this I'm recording this, I think, 2 days after England beat Germany in the Euros, and the headline yesterday in the Daily Mail was, "By George, we've done it." Shoehorning the fucking Prince William's son into the headline. But of course, you could claim that the England have only started winning football matches since they've been condemned as Marxists by Tory MPs. And so you could say that the England team, before taking the knee, and obviously the England team, I think other people have maybe commented on this, but I mean, it seems to me that England have only started winning since they have discovered dialectical and historical materialism and the essential rightness of Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao Tse-tung thought. So if you ever wanted proof that Marxism, Leninism works, then just look at England's victory over... Germany. My cat's making... Hello, Wilf, what do you want? You've got your own door. You can get out. Go on. Wilf is disagreeing.
Wilfie, what's up?
What's the matter? You've got... Use your door. Oh, I'll have to hold his door open. All right, hang on.
Hold the door open for your cat.
You know your door works. No, come on. Wilf, come on. Come on.
Was he pushing when you should have been pulling?
No, he was. He goes in and out of that door all the time, but because they like you to open doors for them, so he feebly pushed at it and then decided it wasn't working, and so I had to open the big door and let him out. He'll be back. So the other big news story this week or last week has been the resignation of Matt Hancock, the health minister, for being replaced by some other bastard. You know, sometimes, though, I think, you know, if you just do material about politicians. It can just be if you is. I think the objective is to try and get at some greater truth, because it's either just kind of gossip in a way, if you're going about what a shitbag, which he undeniably is, Matt Hancock is, or you talk about Tory corruption, you're just kind of shouting in the wind in a way. So at the moment, there's a TV series called Fargo, which is currently in its fourth iteration. It's not without its faults, but I've always been a big fan of Fargo. It's a kind of, in a way, a development of the Coen Brothers film from the 90s. The four series have had some fantastic actors in them over the years. Colin Hanks, Kirsten Dunst, Carrie Coon, Ewan McGregor, David Thewlis, amazing performance in the third series. And they have a loose kind of connection, which is kind of about crime, and they're all obviously set more or less in Minnesota. The fourth series is set in the 1950s, and the two leads are Jason Schwartzman and Chris Rock. But there's also one of the leads is a guy called Timothy Olyphant, who is a phenomenal actor. If you ever saw Deadwood, he played the sheriff in Deadwood and was just a terrific actor. Anyway, there is this in the last episode of Fargo that I watched. There is Timothy Olyphant makes this speech to Chris Rock. Chris Rock is a leader of a black criminal gang. Timothy Olyphant is a U.S. marshal who is tracking down two women who have escaped from prison and have been operating under the protection of Chris Rock. So let's have a listen to, I think it's a fantastic speech. Let's have a listen to it.
I told those ladies no harm would come to them. That makes me accountable.
Should I tell you what I've learned about their criminal mindset? By definition, the criminal rejects accountability, as their identity is based on getting away with things. Similarly, the criminal, you, rejects morality and ethics, for if there is a larger right, then the criminal himself is always wrong. And you don't strike me as the type of man who thinks himself wrong.
Rarely.
So there goes morality, out the window. But into that vacuum, what's your rush? But a code, a system of rules, mostly having to do with loyalty. In this way, the criminal detaches himself from the civilian world.
And yet here I am. Family man, community leader, deacon in the church.
Oh, the criminal is capable of being all those things. But it's a ruse. For though you claim to share the values of your wife or preacher, the Lord knows it's a disguise. Ask me how I know for certain.
How do you know for certain?
Would a family man trade his youngest son to his enemy in exchange for power and monetary gain?
You need to leave.
So when I listened to that clip, I mean, one, I thought it was a terrific piece of acting, but also it suddenly struck me that apart from the description of the criminal, that is a description of Matt Hancock, Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, Prissy Patel, and also I would include in that other right-wing figures on the right of the Labour Party as well, that these are, I mean, and this is not to excuse the left who have different faults, but that idea of that they totally reject morality, that they totally reject accountability is exactly what the Tories are at the moment. I just thought, you know, this is, if you're going to defeat these people, then I think you have to see them in that light as criminals, as people who, you know, you can't you know, Boris Johnson specifically and the rest of his government are made in his image are people who specifically reject accountability, specifically reject morality. These are people utterly without morals and the people who will do anything for personal advancement. So I'm going to probably have a bit more of a think about what that means, you know, in terms of, stand-up material. But I just thought that was an amazing clip, and that perfectly describes our current leadership and also the leadership of the Labour Party.
Do you think they believe they're doing the right thing, or they?
Yeah, I mean, he says, doesn't he, that, yeah, I think people, everybody, you know, everybody kind of lies to themselves, don't they? That everybody believes that they're a decent person. You know, why is this happening to me? Yeah, I mean, I think that there's extraordinary levels of self-delusion. There's also, I mean, levels of, I think, addiction, I think, plays a great part, certainly in this. I sometimes think that the reason they didn't close the borders was it during the pandemic was so it would have stopped the inflow of cocaine, wouldn't it, into Britain. They're like, how am I going to get my Charlie man if you know, if flights from Pakistan are interrupted? You know, that's my explanation for that. I think a lot of them are drunks. A lot of them are sex addicts, addicted to cocaine. And, you know, I think that you have to acknowledge that before you kind of find a way. You can't hold them. I don't know. You can't hold them accountable to our morality. And of course, one of the reasons, well, several, you know, one of the many reasons that they hated and what the whole state apparatus turned on Jeremy Corbyn, one, because, you know, what I was talking about before, he was resistant to wasting all this money on pieces of defense equipment that don't work, but also because he is a ridiculously honest man. Mm. And I think the press, those Koonsbergs, the press, the Pestons, the politicians, the Watsons, the Streetings, the, you know, hated him for that above all else, really.
There are still people out there trying to prove it as well, like going on about how horrible Corbyn was. And
yeah, it's funny, isn't it? They can't let it alone. It's like, they're, you know, the ones, like, you won. You
yeah,
know.
They're the ones who can't let go.
Because they're
trying to justify.
Yeah, they're trying to justify it to themselves. You know, I think some of them now, particularly with the, we're talking on the day of the Batley and Spen by-election, they're trying to desperately to convince themselves. And, of course, Starmer is just utterly useless. Anyway, so I thought that clip from Fargo was amazing. I think that I also want to talk, and I'm trying to think about a big piece of material for the new radio series, the upcoming radio series, about also about the police and about police power and whether police are also have the same mindset as the right-wing politician, really, the same, whether the police are our friend or our an occupying force, you know. I think there's a big question to be asked there, comedically. Mm. So the final part of our podcast, I think, this week is that. Oh, well, are we going to do emails? We're going to end with the second part of my interview with Professor Paul Preston, which is about contemporary Spain. I think you have to be. I mean, I think it has lessons for us in this country as well, but it is to a degree. You have to be interested in Spain, I think, but you can draw lessons. But I'm very happy, I think, with the response. We are also already, other academics have been in touch about, so we started off our A to Z of left-wing thought, which started off with A for anarchy. I think we can do B and C next, which will be Bolshevism/communism.
Oh,
and we've had a recommendation. Yeah, mashup. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, they're kind of the same thing. And, or are they? And we've had a recommendation for an academic who sounds really interesting. So, A to Z of political thought, soon we will be doing B and C. And we're going to finish with my interview, the second part of my interview with Professor Paul Preston. But before that, we're going to do some emails. Is that right?
Yeah, I've got as usual, some lovely emails and messages from our listeners. And yes, that last episode did have a really good response. You might say it might have been divisive, but actually, so many people were saying that was our best episode yet, which was surprised me. So you've got very intellectually hungry people out there.
Yeah.
Who loved that.
Yeah, because it's my best episode. Yeah, it's probably the one where I do the least talk.
That's true.
So, you know, I have mixed feelings about that.
Thank you for all the nice emails that mention me as well. I appreciate that. And we've actually got enough that I should mention on the show. We've got enough emails asking us about the music. They love the Tarbush Records music we use on the show. I know it's like the same three tracks I use over and over, but you know, we'll get some more tunes off them at some point. But yeah, if you want to find more Tarbush Records stuff, they're out there. They've got a SoundCloud page with lots of beats and a YouTube channel where they make really cool videos. If you want more Tarbush Records content, it's all out there. And that, you might see a bit of me on their stuff too, if you look hard enough. thank you so much to everyone who's supported us on the Patreon. It's really invaluable. Like, it really means a lot because, you know, it means we don't have to take adverts on this show. And it's going really well so far. Please keep it coming because we're not quite covering costs yet, but it's really a great help. But thank you to all the new pledgers, Neil, Lowell, Frank, Chris, Bill, Andrew, Durwood, Ian, James, just listing off names, but I'll give you a shout out. Zena, Joseph, Dan, Matthew, Hugh, thank you so much. You can also send us messages through the Patreon. Hugh has been listening to this podcast in hospital and still donated to the Patreon. So wishing you a speedy recovery, Hugh. Yeah.
You sent me an email with somebody called Pierre who wanted to be
It would be his it's his birthday, and he would love you to call him a fat bastard. So if you would call Pierre a fat bastard, that would be great.
Feliz cumpleano, Pierre, fat bastard. Bastardo gordo, I think.
Bastardo gordo, queso grande. Okay, let's switch to the emails now. I had a nice email about jazz music. Someone called Paul remembers you hating jazz and says,
"Yeah,
dear Alexi, give jazz another go. I used to think, as you did, that it was all woodwork teachers singing Hold That Tiger, but then I heard then I heard these songs and thought they were beautiful." And he lists a few of his favorite jazz songs, Best of Blue Note. No, albums, actually. Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. Dave Brubeck, Quartet, Time Out. Mm-hmm. Charlie Mingus. I have to agree with this list. They are frequently in tune. Hardly an angry wasp at all.
I used to say, didn't I, there's two types of jazz and they're both shit. I have actually modified my, partly through listening to Radio 6 Music and Giles Peterson on a Saturday. I'm just 6 Music in general. I do enjoy jazz more than I did, so I take that, those pieces of 80s stand-up, I take them back.
Okay. And there's a lot of good modern jazz too. Kamasi Washington, for example. Okay, that's good to hear. There you go, Paul.
I change, you see. I don't stay, I'm not stuck. That's what makes me different. I'm not stuck. My views continually evolve. You know, once I probably would have been a fan of 40 Cal. Now it's 9mm.
There you go.
We could have a longer discussion. I don't know, it might freak the listeners out, but one of my happiest when I used to write more. I used to write on my web. You know, I've got a web page as well, which I don't really update often. But there was a long discussion about a friend of mine was in a play, a radio play, and she asked me how to pronounce, she had to say the US caliber 30-06, and I told her how to say it, which is 30-06, which was the standard US military caliber before they switched to 5.56. And then we had a lovely discussion on the people, you know, emailing about different calibers and stuff. And, you know, it was one of my favorite editions of my web page, whatever you call it. But I don't know. I don't know whether it's, you know, with it's written down, it seems less creepy, or whether me talking about...
Well, are you talking about guns again?
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about jazz.
What did you think I was talking
about? I was reading emails and suddenly I pay attention and you're fucking talking about guns again. What's going on?
You're talking about ammunition. Yeah. No. Anyway, so we could have an ammunition only. We could do, obviously, the big debate is AK versus M4, M16. That's the big one.
Maybe that could be G in the A to Z of left-wing politics.
Guns, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah.
How weaponry plays into leftism, because...
Oh, hell, fuck yeah. Because obviously the Kalashnikov is the gun of, you know, the assault rifle of the liberation movements, and in a sense has possibly made liberation movements possible, really.
Yeah. Because, you know, leftism is very synonymous with pacifism, but...
But revolutionary thought.
Revolutions have to happen, right? And they're never bloodless, are they?
They are not, no.
Although I had a theory, I always hoped or predicted that the next revolution would be a digital one.
Right.
A digital movement, something that, you know, another way of avoiding...
this is another thing we could talk about on our ICZ. We could talk about whether it is possible, because certainly, obviously, violent revolutionary overthrows by their very nature seem to, in the end, end up more violent than, you know, the thing that they replaced, and that's a kind of a problem.
You end up with cunts in charge after those at the time as well.
Yeah.
Whereas if everyone pulled together online and said, no one vote in the next election, and then everyone just... Like, literally, the election had, like, a 5% voter turnout. And then you'd have ground to stand on to say, we didn't vote for this government. We demand you surrender the House of Parliament to we the people. And fucking
well, good luck with that.
Online movement.
Yeah.
And if enough people stand outside Parliament, they're unstoppable. You know, there's no point fighting.
That's a theory.
But then the army will. Then they'll send in the AFVs.
Yes, exactly. Well, when we get around.
You can run faster than an AFV, so it doesn't sound...
Yeah, when we get round to doing the issue on the police, we can talk about that, because obviously that is what the state, in the end, that is what the democratic state is. It has a monopoly of force, doesn't it? Has a monopoly of violence. That's what we cede to the state. We give the state actors, the police and the army. We say we cannot be violent, but we allow the state to be violent on our behalf. And is that the right way to do things?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure.
People would have to find a way to adopt those two arms of the government. Mm. Yeah. We have time for one more question, and you can choose. Do you want to talk about the New Zealand government? Do you know anything about New Zealand?
No,
Labour
I don't
Party?
Really know. No, I don't.
Okay, then. We haven't talked about friendship applications in a long, 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 long time.
Yeah.
But we get them all the time, and I love it. We've got a big pile of friendship applications, and as promised, come Christmas, something's coming your way.
Something's definitely coming.
All you have to do is send us an email and ask to be Etsy's friend. This one comes from Jessica, but is on behalf of someone else. My name's Freddie Marcel. I'm a tuxedo rescue cat. I'm about 13 years old and 6 months. 6 months ago, had to get my front leg amputated after a sarcoma. Had a hell of a year, and being your friend would really cheer me up.
Well, I think he could be my friend. He can also be Will's friend as well, who's just come back in through his cat door. You see, your fucking door works now, doesn't it?
Was that hit the noise? That's great.
Yeah, he's just come back in.
Oh, man.
You can be my friend, and you can be Will's friend as well.
How lovely. Would you ever go to a cat cafe, Alexi? Do you know what
I'm
they are?
I'm not sure, really. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'd have to find out what the you know, what the animal rights community thinks about them.
Oh,
before I went.
I thought they'd quite positive things. Yeah, you take your cat. I can't imagine. Yeah, I think you take your own cat to the cafe, right? How do they not all just
no,
fight?
No, the cats just live there. It's just a place with a lot of cats. Right.
I thought you bring your own
cat. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. You know, everything, you know, if you're a performer like me who, you know, exists in the left kind of Marxist animal rights universe, you have to...
Meowist.
Yeah, yes. You have to check before you do anything, really.
Yeah, true. Okay, we'll check with Peter and get back to that. Thank you, Stuart, for the friendship application too. He wanted to be my friend as well, so I say yes. Okay, cool. I think that's enough emails for now.
Yeah.
Let's get back to our interview with Professor Paul Preston, yeah?
Let's do it. Adelante. Professor Preston's new book is called The People Betrayed. And also, well, I'll plug the Spanish Holocaust as well, because that was the book that kind of broke the Pacto, El Pacto de Olvido, wasn't it, really, in a way?
Well, the weird thing about the so-called Pact of Forgetfulness is that there never was such a thing.
See, that's another thing.
Well, what there was, okay. So Franco dies in November 1975. And he has named, you know, his royal successor. He has created a law which says Spain is a monarchy without a king, and the regent for life will be Francisco Franco, and within his rights are to name his royal successor. So he dies 20th of November 1975, leaving as head of state Juan Carlos, you know, who has no right, no legal right other than within Francoist law. Now, for a variety of reasons, I mean, now, of course, it's absolutely not the thing to speak highly of Juan Carlos, given that he's mired in all kinds of, you know, sexual and financial scandals and so on. But anyway.
Yeah, he seemed like a mensch when, you know, after the Franco's death.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, basically... For whatever reason, you know, the question is asked, well, was he really a Democrat? It doesn't matter. He was convinced for a variety of reasons. Obviously, he thinks that his job in life, his vocation, is to keep his family, or to get his family on the throne and keep his family on the throne. That's how royal families function. You know, that's what they're all about. And his wife, who's Greek, has gone through the traumas of being, you know, her family being overthrown by a military coup. She is very close to the British royal family, obviously because of, you know, Duke of Edinburgh and so on, who's her uncle. And Juan Carlos is getting all kinds of advice from British diplomats, from American diplomats, and effectively all the advice is, the only way you're going to be able to stay on the throne is in a democrat, you know, is by some kind of democratic reform. If you try to do what Franco trained you to do, which is to keep the dictatorship going, you're not going to last. And he accepts that, actually very courageously, because, you know, at the point at which Franco dies, and there is one of these other myths is that Franco wanted Spain to become a democracy, which is, you know, hysterically ludicrous to my view. I mean, you know, I've got evidence of Franco's collaborators saying to him, you've got to be really careful about that Juan Carlos, you know, he's got democratic inclinations. And he goes, no, you know, it's not a problem. You know, I've trained him, and there are the institutions and the oaths. You know, in other words, I've built a series of institutions that trap him, and he's been forced to make a series of oaths in public. You know, not a problem. Well, what he does is, I mean, his first problem, he comes into power, and you've got nothing's changed with the death of Franco, other than Franco's dead, but you've still got the civil guard, the armed forces, the armed police, as it, you know, La Policía Armada, the Greases, as we used to call them, because their uniform was dark grey, all of whom have been trained to keep democracy out of Spain, to crush the left. That is their job. Their job is to defend Spain from the internal enemy. The internal enemy of the communists, above all, but only the left in general. And what he does, what Juan Carlos does, is he neutralizes or pacifies, you know, the high command of the army and all these things by, you know, it's all right, I'm going to be doing Franco's will, I'm going to fulfill his legacy and so on. While in the meanwhile, through some unbelievably clever constitutional lawyers, working out how, without changing these, or without, as it were, betraying or traducing these institutions, you know, that little changes make it possible. So, you know, the first 6 months, very conservative, and everyone, including me, I was writing newspaper articles at the time, referring to him as Juan Carlos the Brief, and, you know, that he's not going to be around very long. And then after 6 months, in June of 1976, he brings in this young, very televisual guy, Adolfo Suarez. And you get this thing where, if you like, Juan Carlos is the impresario. There's a guy called Torquato Fernández Miranda who's like the script writer. And Adolfo Suarez is the actor. And they do this production, which basically leads to a referendum on a political reform and so on. I mean, when they get the political reform through the Francoist Cortes, which is a pseudo-parliament, you know, the guys that they know are going to vote against, they send them on paid holidays to Jamaica and so on. Again, it's the they use the techniques that have been learned over years of electoral corruption.
Right.
And basically, you know, this leads to the first democratic elections in June 1977. Now, at that point, the population, I mean, the bulk of the population, you know, is keen on democracy, is keen on reform. On the other hand, you have a very powerful section of the population which doesn't really want any change, because what Franco has done, what this regime has done, so unlike, say, Hitler's Germany or Mussolini's Italy, that has not been a pro, because they weren't occupied. They weren't defeated. You know, they were defeated and were occupied by the Allies, who imposed a process of denazification.
Right.
None of that in Spain.
Yeah.
So Franco has 40 years with total control over the education system, total control over the media, to build this notion that he is this, you know, benevolent genius who has done wonderful things for Spain, saved Spain from the communist menace, etc. And a lot of people believe that. Now, of course, when a democratic regime comes into power, and it's very conservative, there isn't going to be a counter brainwashing because it's democratic. There's freedom of speech. So all those people who've grown up thinking Franco's great, go on thinking Franco's great. So that's one of the real problems. Now, the people who are pleased that there's been a change to democracy, and of course there are businessmen and capitalists who want to see this as a way into the EU, and
it's always think like the cars they used to make in Spain were nuts, weren't they? Because they were like, they used to make a domestic. There was a British Leyland plant there, wasn't it? They used to make a car called the Victoria, and the front end was like an 1100, and the back end was a Triumph. I can't remember. It was some like weird looking bloody thing. Anyway, they used to make a lot of weird. Anyway, that's weird looking cars. Yeah, that's my obsession.
That's for another program.
Yeah.
Anyway, so basically, the government that came into power in October of 1977 introduced an amnesty law in the hope of sort of preventing, you know, because obviously there was like built up hatreds and resentments over, you know, because all kinds of issues to do with the Civil War had never been resolved for obvious reasons. And what this law said was that anyone who was guilty of crimes against humanity committed in defense of the previous regime, I mean, the Franco regime, could not be prosecuted judicially. So it was saying, they're off the hook. And so as to, you know, anyone who was guilty of crimes of terrorism against the regime was also could not be prosecuted. Okay. Now, how do you define crimes of terrorism? So there was the guerrilla war that took place between 1945 and 1951, which in numerical terms, the number of casualties of Francoist, but it was a mini war.
Yeah.
So they counted. And, of course, ETA and the atrocities committed by ETA, they all counted. So that was, if you like, the nearest thing to a legal basis for the Pacto del Olvido was that. But basically what there was this, a big civic desire, we don't want another civil war. You know, that's the last thing we want. We don't want another dictatorship, etc. And so that opened the way, you know, to, well, first of all, nothing was done because, of course, Francoist thinking was still very, very prominent. And there's also the thing that, okay, the generation that had actually been through the Civil War, those who hadn't been killed, murdered, forced into exile, or, you know, there were a million people in concentration camps at the end of the Civil War, they were just brought up in a culture of silence, you know, and, I mean, the social persecution, you know, losing jobs, having your goods confiscated, you know, the Franco regime was a regime of pillage. But even their kids were brought up in a kind of culture of silence. You know, don't for God's sake at school mention that we're Republicans, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a hell of a lot of, you know, the fear. There was a regime of fear. And it was really only round at the late 90s that people who were actually the grandchildren started to demand to know what had happened. You know, where's my grandfather buried? I want to know. I know he was killed and so on. And that began a huge movement called the Movimiento para la Recuperación de la Memoria Histórica, for the recovery of historical memory. And there were all over Spain, local associations grew up, and they tried to start excavation. Of course, the excavations and the DNA testing cost a fortune. And the one thing that had happened before, there were always a number of terrific local historians who had been battling away trying to find out what had happened in their area. And when I wrote my book, The Spanish Holocaust, I was terrified because literally for years, about once a month, I get a box of books because I'd built up this network of the people that, you know, around. And of course, they would, and some of the stuff was quite funny because it'd be things like, and everybody would, say, in a particular village, everyone would gather in the hut of John, the chicken castrator. And you'd think, and where was that? So my job, in a way, I mean, I did obviously did research on my own, but was putting all this together.
Right.
And the nicest review that the book, when I finally finished the book and it came out, it overall got a terrific reception. But the nicest review I got was, I think it was in The Independent, which was then a newspaper, said, you know, this is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that Spain never had. You know, I was just so touched by that, you know. But
Jumping ahead, then, what do you think of the prospects for, you know, what's your view of contemporary Spain then? Because obviously there's the, you know, there's, you see kind of the extreme right is on the rise, of Vox and Ciudadanos, and but also there's Podemos and...
It does change very, very fast. I think, you know, things were on a relatively even keel until about 2006 when the Partido Popular and its then leader, Mariano Rajoy, this was before all the corruption scandals that I deal with in A People Betrayed. There was a movement on the part of the Catalans who had a reasonable autonomy statute to reform the autonomy statute to push it further. And there was a long process whereby it went through Catalan Parliament, then through the Spanish Parliament, and then just when everyone was kind of agreed, Rajoy took it to the Tribunal of Constitutional Guarantees, claiming that it was anti-constitutional. And it then got tied up in legal, you know, shenanigans for years. And this embittered the, you know, so basically you had the right, and it was all manipulated for electoral terms, you know, for electoral reasons. You know, those Catalans, they want to break up Spain and so on. They think they are just because they're rich. You know, there was a lot of very effective propaganda coming from the right in Spain. And of course, inevitably, there was a, you know, there was a counter propaganda coming from Catalonia. There used to be a program, well, there is, it's still on, I think, the morning radio show in Catalonia. It's the equivalent of, you know, the radio for whatever the Today program. It was called Els Matins de Catalunya Radio, the morning with Catalonia Radio. It used to be done by a guy, hugely important journalist in Catalonia called Toni Bassas. He's now editor of the newspaper Ara. Anyway, he said to me, how would you feel if we did the programme one day from your office in London? I said, I'd love it. You know, we'd get footballers on and all kinds of things. So anyway, so he arrives, and you can imagine, to do this big show, there's two trucks, two Pantechnicons of technical gear, you know, the generators, all kinds of stuff. And the night before, I for years did this a seminar on Spain, it was open to the public. So he offered to do one. And of course, it was unlike anything we'd ever had because it was all whistles and flutes and, you know, audiovisual aids and everything you could imagine. This must have been in the middle of this crisis I was talking about. And the paper or the talk he gave was about the differences between how the Catalan media dealt with Spain and in contrast with how the Spanish media dealt with Catalonia. And at the time, the socialists were in power in Spain. And he actually played a bit from a radio show. The most extreme right-wing radio show at the time was actually run by the Bishops' Conference. and in this particular clip, the guy said, I've often wondered about, I can't remember his name now, the Prime Minister, what is it about, you know, why does he only ever talk to Catalans and queers? And the audience laughed, you see, because they assumed it was like spitting image or something like that, you know. And and Tony said, no, this is the level of the debate, you know. But anyway, that's when things really soured, I think, you know. And then there were problems within Catalonia, and the successor to Jordi Pujol, who for years was the head, and then, of course, later on got mired in corruption himself. But his successor, Artur Mas, realised that, you know, he was losing ground to young independentistas and took a very pro-separatist line. So the whole thing just kind of escalated on both sides. And the socialist part, I mean, and it's so complicated to try to describe, you know, the corruption issues on both sides. And,
I never get a sense in Spain. It's not like of corruption on a kind of, it doesn't seem like Italy. The corruption seems different, really. Am I deluding myself there?
I think it is different. I mean, I happen to think that, you know, the establishment here is totally corrupt, but it's very, 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 very different. Here it is very, if you like, it's legal. You know,
you never seem like you have to bribe anybody in Spain. Am I deluded about that?
No, it's all envelope full of money. You know, I said earlier that in the chapter that was the nearest to funny of a, within a book about a story that's not remotely funny, was the chapter about the Primo de Rivera dictatorship, where the scale of corruption was absolutely eye-watering.
Yeah.
But actually, in the last chapters of that book, which deal with the situation in the last 10-15 years, some of the anecdotes about corruption are, I mean, if they're grotesque,
they're
actually funny. Okay, so there's one case where there's a guy comes under suspicion. It turns out it's his salary is a modest salary working as a municipal employee. You know, it turns out he has three estates. And when the police do a search on the biggest of them, they find he's got a helicopter, he's got a fleet of Bentleys, Lamborghinis, Ferraris, etc. He's got a stable of 100 Arab ponies. He has a whole series of great masterpieces, you know, by El Greco and Goya and Picasso, right, one thing and another. And large numbers of bin bags full of 500 euro notes, you know. And what did he say when the police said, and how do you afford all this? And he said, well, you know, I've got quite a good salary as the, as the planning officer. It is grotesque rather than funny. But
I think, so this has been a journey of disillusion for me anyway. You've shattered all my illusions about everything, but thank you very much, Professor.
I hope I haven't put you off Spanish food or Spanish wine.
No. Right.
That's the main thing.
I'm crazy about Spain. That was Professor Paul Preston. And one of the things about this, having this podcast, both the bike rides and the podcast, is I'm using it as a way to meet interesting men and hopefully also interesting women. It's been a bit male focused. But in that, connected with that department, connected with the bike rides, next Thursday, which will be early July, I am going to be joining the commentary team on ITV4's coverage of the Tour de France. So I'm going to be with Chris Boardman, Ned Bolting, David Miller, Gary Imlach, all my heroes. And I think they're only going to let me join them when it gets really quiet in the afternoon. So I don't know if I'm going to be in the highlights, but I am going to be joining the commentary team of the Tour de France next Thursday. So that is really, cool, in some ways, the peak of my recording career. So if you want to listen, if you're around, you've got nothing to do in the afternoon, listen to the live commentary of the Tour de France next Thursday, because I'll be there. Bye-bye. The Alexis L podcast is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music is by Tarbush Records. If you want to find out more about either of them or anything, there's a link in the description of the podcast. Sound mixing by Anthony Overton. Thanks to Audio Boom. See you next time.